just a good looking pan. And any barmaid can be a star, mate, if she dances with or without a man. Hooray for Hollywood! When you're terrific, if you're even good, where anyone at all from Shirley Temple to Amy Semple is equally understood. Go out and try your luck, you may be gone.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, you are listening to a Rattlegion Broadcasting premiere podcast. Damn you, Hollywood! And here's your host, me, Mark Rattledge. So weird to do that without Robert. Also really weird to do that on camera. Now I have to like do hand motions and stuff.
I was about to ask, do you usually do the hand motions when you're just doing it on a regular audio podcast, or is this a new thing for you?
Both, yes. I have definitely been very animated on the podcast before, but now I have to be kind of aware of it when I'm doing it. So as you can see on the video, and for those of you listening on the podcast, we are joined by Alexis Haina from Honeysuckle Rose Creations.
Always happy to be here.
And joining us also, first time on camera, but not the first time she's joined Damn You Hollywood. She was with us for Demon Slayer The Mugen Train review with Robert Winfrey, who is not here tonight because musicals. Lily Rattledge, how you doing, Lily?
Hi!
We bought her a new computer for this.
Yes. Yeah.
Nice way to get a new computer.
Hey, do you want to be on the podcast? Yes, great. We have to get you a computer that works then.
Oh, I figured it was the other way around. It's like, you want to be on the podcast? Yes, but you need to get me a computer that works.
No, she didn't hold us hostage. We just needed, we needed equipment upgrades. That and my wife's laptop hit the fritz this morning. Because right when we're always ready to do something, that's when something breaks.
Naturally.
Absolutely. As you can see in the ticker on the video, but for those of you, and if you clicked on the podcast, you know what we're doing tonight. We are talking In the Heights.
In the Heights.
In the Heights.
I'm not singing.
That's fine.
That's fine.
There'll be a lot of singing and dancing on this podcast, but not from Alexis Haina. I dance for no man. So let's just kind of roundtable this before we jump into the movies. Alexis, so you're a fan of musicals. We had talked about this before. Just kind of give the brief history of, have you been in musicals, worked on them, like stage productions, or you know, just kind of been a fan? When did you start watching musicals, listening, etc.?
Well, I've never really been involved in musicals per se because my singing is the equivalent of a dog whistle. Growing up, my school always did them, and I always covered them for school paper and stuff. So I've always been a fan. And yeah, I've been a crazy huge fan of Lin-Manuel Miranda since he first debuted. The man is a genius. There really is no other way to say it. He is brilliant. And I loved Hamilton. I haven't seen it in person because I haven't sold my soul to get tickets. But we did see it when it debuted on Disney Plus, and I actually hosted a watch party for it.
Wow.
Because my parents do not have Disney Plus, and my mother, I got my mother tickets for us to see Wicked for her birthday. Mm-hmm. This was like right before the end of the world. And I remember calling her saying, what if I told you I got tickets for us to see Wicked? And her exact words were, well, can you let me know when you get tickets to see Hamilton?
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, yeah, okay, good point. And when Disney Plus announced they were going to play it, I immediately texted her going, so I'm assuming you guys will be coming over to watch this. So yeah, she, my dad, my aunt, a couple other people came over because apparently we were the only ones who had Disney Plus at the time. And we all just absolutely loved it. It was so much fun to watch.
Lily just got me to watch Hamilton the other day. Lily, who hipped you to Hamilton? How'd you find out about it?
I don't know. I think it was the most talked about thing, I think, in my musical theater group, because musicals.
Yes.
So So I think I got it for them. I can't remember now. All I know is that I watched it and I loved it.
How long have you been doing musical theater for? When did you start? First grade, second grade?
Maybe first. I think first grade.
Yeah, because we had had you in dance at the Y, and you were not loving straight dance and ballet and all of that. So we found the Jansen Musical Theater Group through a mutual friend of my wife's. And yeah, you've been doing it ever since. You love musicals, right? You love being in, on stage and performing?
Yeah, I love being in musicals. It's just I've noticed over time I'm either in a chorus or I have a character that only appears like once or twice.
Well, yeah, that'll change over time, I'm sure, as you get better at it. All right, so just a quick word about Hamilton. So I watched it the first time, and you, Alexis, you and I had talked off show about watching Hamilton in kind of preparation for going to see In the Heights, probably to compare and contrast the similarities, sort of see what his style was. Just kind of going into In the Heights based on what you saw in Hamilton, what were your expectations?
Well, I knew that this was that Manuel Miranda made this before Hamilton. Mm-hmm. So I expected to see sort of a proto ideas for Hamilton. And I think you can see that in a lot of the songs. You can see the roots of where some of the song styles took place and how he has further honed his craft, as it were.
Yeah.
The other thing I was interested in was the direction, John M. Chu. Who directed Crazy Rich Asians, which is a very good movie.
I was going to say, did you see it?
Yes, I did see Crazy Rich Asians. Unfortunately, John M. Chu is also the one who brought us that Jim and the Holograms movie.
Yeah!
So
I took Lily to go see that when it came out, and our review of that will be up next year.
Will you let him torture you like that?
I live with him, so I have to deal with this a lot.
No, the right answer was you liked Jem and the Holograms because you were like 7 at the time.
Wait, did I?
Yes.
I don't remember.
You also liked Charlie's Angels, which made you the bane of every male adult on the internet. With Elizabeth Banks, Charlie Angels.
Yeah, glad you were able to see Jem and the Holograms during the 2 weeks that it was actually in theaters, because it got removed after only 2 weeks.
Yeah, I was going to say it was out of theaters before the movie was over.
Yeah, exactly. It only made half its budget back. And considering how low budget that film was already, that's saying something. But yeah, I was joking when I saw that he was directing. I'm like, okay, because Crazy Rich Asians, great movie. But has he redeemed himself yet for Jem and the Holograms? We need to find out.
So, yeah, you can definitely see a lot of the style from Hamilton that came from In the Heights. Have you ever read the book that it was based on?
I do not have a month to dedicate to how thick that book is.
Okay, so you're aware of it, but it's a bit of a tome, huh?
It's huge. It's thicker than Stephen King books.
Before we jump into the review proper, Lily, just kind of in your mind, as you watched the movie, you'd already seen Hamilton. Did it feel kind of more of the same for you? Was there any differences you thought like, oh, this is kind of different from the way Hamilton is? What were as you were watching In the Heights and thinking about Hamilton, what were some of your thoughts?
Some of the sounds in it matched the Hamilton songs. Mm-hmm. So like, there are some tunes from like the upbeat songs, like not the ones that felt really sad to some of us, like death or something. It was more like an upbeat kind of scene, like Aaron Burser, the Schuyler Sisters, Alexander Hamilton, like those songs.
Yeah.
There, I felt that in it, but not like other songs like
okay.
Burn and Say No to This, like those songs.
Yeah. Rap is an interesting musical medium, not a whole lot of different ways to do it. And so that was sort of my thought as I was watching this. We watched Hamilton first the other day, and there you can hear some semblance of traditional singing in there, but it's a lot of rapping, and rapping is talking in a rhythmical way. By the way, the guy that plays Thomas Jefferson and obviously King George, the two best in Hamilton, in my opinion. Their songs were great. Their style was great. The content of the lyrics made me laugh each time. And the guy playing Thomas Jefferson, as he was doing, you know, like some of his dances, he's kind of doing a, you know, one of those deals. I thought that was fantastic. I laughed every time. And there's a lot of that in the Heights. You know, there's essentially a lot of the songs almost in a, like a rap opera kind of way. characters are talking to each other. So like Usnavi is talking to, I can't remember the character's name, but he runs the cab company. And he's like, here's your, you know, and the conversation essentially is, here's your coffee. Thank you. But they got to do it in a rapping style.
Benny. His name is Benny.
Thank you. All right. So In the Heights is a 2021 American musical drama film based on the stage musical of the same name. I got to get used to doing this. There it is. Here we go. And we're talking about In the Heights, and those are things that are happening. And yeah. All right. So anyway, In the Heights is based on the stage musical of the same name by Chiara Alegria Hudes and Lin-Manuel Miranda. It was directed by M. Chu, as we talked about, John M. Chu, who directed Crazy Rich Asians. It stars Anthony Ramos, Corey Hawkins, Leslie Grace, Melissa Barrera, Olga Marides, Daphne Ruben Vega, Gregory Diaz IV, and Jimmy Smits. Jimmy Smits is in the movie.
Okay.
All right. that's a Red Letter Media joke. Who's Navi? Yes.
So the person who is selling the shaved ice, I don't know if anyone else noticed, but I think it's Lin-Manuel Miranda.
It is Lin-Manuel.
Knew it.
Yeah, he actually originally played Usnavi on the off-Broadway. Obviously, he didn't want to play the lead role in it for this, so he decided to take a smaller part.
I liked him as the shaved ice guy.
He was fine.
And also the this and the ice cream guy is George Washington.
It is. He's been in nearly every production Lin-Manuel Miranda has done.
Really?
He's either a major star or he makes sure he's got a bit role, but he puts him in every single bit.
He is a tall drink of water, that dude. Big dude.
Oh, yeah.
Usnavi de la Vega tells children the story of Washington Heights. Owning a bodega, he introduces Abuela Claudia, the matriarch of the neighborhood who raised him, Kevin Rosario, who runs a taxi company, Kevin's employee, Benny, the salon ladies, Daniela, Carla, and Kuka, and Vanessa, Usnavi's love interest, and his cousin, Sonny. Alejandro, an attorney and family friend, informs Usnavi his late father's business in the Dominican Republic, which he dreams of reviving, is for sale. Meanwhile, Kevin's daughter Nina returns from Stanford. After seeing Benny from Benny's dispatch, she finds her father telling him she can't pay tuition, but he brushes her off, telling her not to worry. The plot synopsis I'm reading it also has the song that's going on while this is happening. So that's Breathe. And the previous song was Benny's Dispatch, and the previous song was In the Heights. Daniela's salon is moving to the Bronx, the boogie down Bronx, due to rising rent. Nina arrives for a treatment, but reveals she has dropped out of Stanford and leaves. No me diga, I believe is the song. Vanessa submits a rental application downtown where she dreams of becoming a fashion designer, but her application is rejected. It won't be long now. She heads to Usnavi's bodega, where Sonny asks her out for him. Sonny learns a lottery ticket the bodega sold won $96,000 in the public pool. The neighborhood fantasizes about what they would do with the money. While the Piraguero laments how Mr. Sofi is stealing his business, Piragua, that weekend, Benny and Nina reminisce about their childhood. She expresses her doubts and fears, but she reassures her that she is destined for greatness when you're home. Meanwhile, Usnavi talks to Sonny's father about letting him go to the Dominican Republic, but he implies he and Sonny are undocumented immigrants and cannot leave. That evening, Kevin reveals he sold his business to pay for Nina's tuition. Outraged, she refuses the money and storms out. Usnavi and Vanessa head to a salsa club for their date with Bonnie and Nina. At the club, Usnavi is nervous and aloof, causing him to decline to dance with Vanessa. Instead, a man steals her away for a dance, allowing multiple men to continue to dance with her. Making Usnavi jealous, he tries to make her jealous too by dancing with another woman, the club. The power goes out, like it does, and Sonny and Graffiti Pete light up fireworks, illuminating the neighborhood. Vanessa and Usnavi argue, and she rejects him. Blackout. Lying in bed, Abuela reminisces about her childhood in Cuba and how she came to New York City and during hardships to be where she is today. I'm going to massacre this. Paciencia Ive. She passes and the neighborhood comes together to mourn and sing her praises. Alabanza. At protests for DACA, Sonny learns he cannot go to college as he is undocumented, and Nina suddenly realizes his tuition.
His situation.
situation. Jesus Christ. She resolves to go back to Stanford and find a way for undocumented immigrant children to find a pathway in life. Usnavi finds Vanessa's wrestle application in the trash. He visits Daniela, asking her to co-sign on Vanessa's application. Disappointed with the block's negativity over the blackout and Ebola passing, Daniela arouses them into a celebration, and the blackout ends. Carnaval de Barrio. A month later, Nina is about to return to Stanford. Benny promises to find a way for her to join in Palo Alto, and they kiss when the sun goes down. As Usnavi prepares to leave for the Dominican Republic, he discovers that Abuela held the winning lottery ticket and has left it to him. Vanessa shows up, having found out that Usnavi got Daniela to co-sign for her lease and bought him champagne. She suggests Usnavi stay, but he refuses. She kisses him, lamenting that she was too late and realizing her feelings. Champagne. Usnavi gives Alejandro the lottery ticket, telling him to use it for Sunny's DACA fees. The next morning, Vanessa takes Usnavi to the bodega and shows him a fashion line she created the previous night. Seeing Pete's mural celebrating Abuela, Usnavi decides to stay, because of course he does. The story returns to present day, where Usnavi is revealed to be telling his story in the news shop in New York City, and one of the children is Usnavi and Vanessa's daughter, because of course she is. They sing and dance in the street finale, and in the post-credits scene, Peter Guerrero celebrates his victory over Mr. Soft to be raising prices of a dollar. Ha! Piragua! All righty. So, Alexis, I will go to you first. Tell me your thoughts on the craft of this movie.
This movie was so well done. The direction was great. The performers were all really good. The music flowed and fit every scene. It was a very, very well done musical. Every actor could tell was putting in so much passion, so much enthusiasm into their parts. I loved every minute of it. I think my favorite musical number has got to be 96,000. The way that those shots were done was crazy creative. You have one scene of it going above the water, then below the water, and then you know, kind of goes back on. You have all these people dancing in the pool. I can't even begin to think about how crazy the choreography was for that scene, just how hard it must have been. I was reading IMDb, apparently that took 3 days to film that one scene, because they had to make sure that the weather was right. I guess there were some issues with some lightning for a good chunk of one of the days, and obviously they couldn't have anyone near the water when there's lightning bolts. But it was just so impressive how well done that was. You know, you see just a massive grand scale musical like that, not to mention a musical that there's a little CGI, but not that much. So you watch 96 Engine and you think how much of that was done practically. Again, very impressive work.
Yeah, I have to agree. The camera work on this, especially for 96,000, and what was the name of the one where Benny and Nina are dancing on the side of the building?
I don't know.
When the Sun Goes Down.
Yeah, When the Sun Goes Down. 96,000 and When the Sun Goes Down were probably my two favorite ones, just because, you know, this being a cinematic visual experience, the camera work on it was so good. You know, being able to capture a stage production on screen and make it visually appealing and enthralling and keeping people's interest over the, how long did this thing, what was this? Over the, you know, the 2 hours, the 20 minutes that this picture took place, is a feat unto itself. And what, you know, this is a very attractive cast. The songs were mostly very upbeat. You know, this was one that sort of invites you to dance to it. I'll get to you in a second about that, Lily, because I know you were dancing in the theater. But the visuals, I think, are the key. And, you know, and is it just kind of a stage shot where, you know, kind of like if you remember Grease, where they would do the big dance numbers, they just would pull back the camera and everyone's kind of dancing, you know, from left to right across the screen. But they don't necessarily do a lot of camera trickery with the old, you know, Grease movie, where this one, they would do, you know, like a 96,000, you know, you're right, they would do like the underwater shots and they were moving around. And I have to say, if this doesn't get at least a nomination for whatever would incorporate blocking and dancing for the Oscars in a picture, I don't know what else would. the blocking in this was one thing, was definitely something that I noticed, how dynamic it was, how the actors were able to, I'm going to use the word almost mechanically, but I don't mean to say that it was like devoid of life. Like, it, there was so much happening in the frame with actual people, nothing CGI'd, that I don't want to go as far as say it was overwhelming, but it was definitely like, it definitely brought me into the picture, Alexis.
Definitely. Like, for example, during the 96,000, you get the guys dance, Sonny leading a bunch of guys dancing in the pool. And then all of a sudden you have a woman just kind of casually float in on a floaty, just right at the end, the way it was, mm-hmm. that was so well set up and framed. I'm guessing way, that would
did
be
you under- see shoulder guy, the shoulder guy. Did you see him? The guy like doing a weird thing with his shoulder in the pool, just like just one row back from whoever, I think it was Sonny singing in the front.
I don't think I saw that. No.
Lily, you saw shoulder guy, right?
I think I did.
Yeah, the guy doing the weird shoulder thing.
Oh yeah, I remember now.
That was crazy. He was the only one doing it.
Like, oh yeah, yeah. There were two.
There were two? Okay.
Yeah, there were two doing that thing, and I was like, I like step back for a second.
So they got a couple of double jointed guys to dance with them.
What can I say? I was easily impressed.
I think the award that would go to is either best editing or best cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right, we'll shift over to you, Lily. What did you think of In the Heights?
Amazing. I loved all the music and all the dancing, and the actors were amazing.
What was your favorite song?
I have three, but one of them I'm afraid to say.
Well, tell me about that one.
The scene where they're all in the salon,
mm-hmm.
and like Nina has entered.
Yeah,
that song is my favorite, and then the two others are In the Heights and 96,000.
What was this? So tell me about. Let's talk about that salon scene for 1 second. So Nina goes into the salon, and they're like, "Hey, you're the one that made it out of here. We're so proud of you." She's like, "Yeah, I dropped out." So that's the whole sequence essentially. What about that song was so appealing to you? What did you like about it specifically?
The salon scene is just very funny,
mm-hmm.
and just hearing them all talk, it's funny to mm-hmm. hear.
Okay, I would agree with you. I was amused by the salon scene. It's funny, Stephanie Beatrice, who plays in the show Brooklyn Nine-Nine, she has a very deep voice on that show, but I've heard her in other stuff. Like, her natural voice apparently is very high. Are you familiar with Stephanie Beatrice, Alexis?
Not totally. I hate to admit, I haven't got a chance to watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine as of yet.
Yeah, she has a very, very, like, deep, you know, not necessarily manly, but very, like threatening voice. That's basically her character. But every time she uses her natural voice, and I think even in the first season of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, she has apparently a very high, squeaky voice. So later on, when they're talking about, you know, they're in the middle of the blackout, and they have it's the carnival song. And she has the one line in the song about, you know, my parents are from all these places in South America and Central America, but I just say I'm from Queens. I laughed at that, not necessarily because it's like a funny line. The way she says it is hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
Real quick about the salon girl. Somebody, I listened to the critically acclaimed podcast review on this, and Dasha Polanco, who is one of the characters from, she's one of the salon ladies. She's the one with the booby shake. Yeah, I saw that and I looked over at you to see if you were like covered up with your hood.
Nope.
Dasha Polanco in this, she was just like, "Hey, we need someone to shake boobs and butts in this. Can you do that? We're not gonna give you any dialogue, but do a lot of eye shifting, boob shaking, and you know, and butt rolling." And she's like, "Got it. What's my motivation? You're in the movie. That's your motivation." So Dasha Polanco. They had noticed that, like, she's a great actress. She was in something else recently that I saw, but the big thing that she was in was Orange is the New Black. And other than visual stuff, they gave her nothing to do in this movie. She's third salon girl, Alexis. Are you familiar with her at all?
No.
Nah, no idea. have any thoughts on why they made it a point? Apparently, this was very different from either the stage production or the stage production. That they added her in there, but then she's just visual eye candy. I guess they don't really do anything with her.
Well, I guess they just thought that it looked better to have three women as opposed to two, and you know what, it works.
Yeah, symmetry. As far as the plot of this thing, such as it is, I mean, everything that I've read about this is it's basically a love letter to that section of New York, which, you know, when I lived there, I was aware that it was a very Dominican area, but I guess it's, you know, not just Dominican. There's a lot of different Central and South American Latino folks that live there. Kind of like Rent, Alexis, the film kind of talks about gentrification and the changing of the neighborhood. Lily, gentrification is basically a lot of rich people moving in and the price of everything going up and the poor people that live there having to move out. That's essentially gentrification. Here's the thing. As far as, you know, Usnavi has a dream. You know, his dream is to get out of the city and go to his paradise, the Dominican Republic, to go home again and to start his dad's business. So that's not really speaking to the theme of gentrification. Then you have Nina, who got out. You know, she studied hard. She got out. She went to Stanford. And then while she's there, she struggles with identity. She struggles with the pressure of it all. And she decides that she's going to come back because she doesn't want to deal with it. Not speaking to gentrification. The two things that kind of speak to it, and I'll kind of start there to get your opinions on the matter, is the cab company selling half the business and then the whole business to another buyer. And that kind of speaks to the idea of businesses are moving in, legacy businesses are having to move out, which goes to the salon, which is, hey, all my customers have left, you know? And so the customers that are in the salon are like, no, don't leave us. But she's like, hey, I got to go, you know? The rent's better. Half of our clientele is there. It's just a better idea. So the movie points to, in a lot of ways, struggling with the changing of the neighborhood. But there's so much of it is just song and dance. I don't know how well or how coherently it did speak to those things. I feel like it just sort of pointed to them, but it doesn't really discuss it on any kind of sociopolitical level. And maybe it's not supposed to, but it'd be hard for me to imagine there's a book about this that didn't speak to those things specifically and coherently.
Definitely. Nina felt was one of the more identifiable characters. You know, even if we're not the one who got out as she is, we all can identify with the concept of just having that pressure on us, feeling like, you know, so many people are counting on us. So much is expected of us. I think at one point in all of our lives, we've wondered, are we living up to what everyone thought we were going to do? Are we living up to what was said about us when we were growing up? And yeah, it really, the speech that Nina gives at the dinner table, when she talks about how she was racially discriminated against by her roommate, was very unsettling. You know, the fact that this roommate lost her pearl necklace, and her parents came and they pointed fingers at her and they started calling herself. And where was the pearl necklace? In the roommate's bag.
Because of course it was.
Yeah, she hadn't lost it. She just wasn't checking her bag. But it clearly affected her. And she talks about how when she's in Washington Heights, she belongs.
Right.
You know, she is with people of her similar ancestry. She's with people who know what she's going through. When she got to Stanford, she didn't have that. Mm-hmm. Didn't have the group. And again, that's also something that's identifiable. How many times we've been in a situation where we really can't seem to find our niche, our clique, our, you know, something that remind, you know, our friends right. remind us of home. We have all been there, and it's very unsettling. And it's very easy to say, to just want to say, screw this. I'm going back where I know people will accept me. And of course she has to deal with that. She's like, even though that no one seems to get that that's what she wants.
Yeah.
It's like, you got out, you could do this. She's like, but I didn't want to get out. I want to come back.
It is amazing how much like setting your comfortability help promote the things that allow you to do great things. But when you're absent those things, how, you know, without your foundation, the stuff built on top of it kind of crumbles. And so she wouldn't be the first person, and she won't be the last, to go away to school, you know, having done really well in this environment, and then take the next step, go away, and it's not working out for her. So I would agree with you that Nina was very relatable. What did you think about Nina's story, Lily? You know, this idea of I'm going away to do great things. Jesus, you know, between the racial discrimination and the pressure, this isn't working out for me.
I did not really like the fact that Nina was the first to get pointed at for stealing the pearl necklace. That really kind of hurt me, because I know many people would probably have that, like, being pointed at because the person who lost the thing thought that she took it. I didn't like it.
Yeah. Going back to the, you know, speaking to some of the sociopolitical stuff, Alexis, like I said, it addresses it. I think it addresses it in a way that's relatable. If I have to come up with something like really critical to say about it, I feel like, because there's so much focus on the sort of broad entertainment aspects of a movie like this, I think it doesn't do the best job of really explaining to the audience what's the problem with the Heights. You know, why are we singing and dancing about it? Why are we telling this story? What about this story needs to be shouted from the hilltops? I think it's very easy to sort of watch this thing sort of be passively entertained and be like, yeah, this was great. Beautiful cast, great dancing, love the songs. And then you walk away and you're like, you're not really left with an impression of what's happening in this world that caused these problems in the first place. You're like, well, that's a thing that's ended now. Let's go get a sandwich.
I guess there's a little bit of that. But on the same time, I don't think they wanted to go into that much socio-political economic situations. I was
worried. Hang on a second. Let me just give it as a comparison. At least Les Miserables spoke to the French Revolution and the problems going on there, you know. And so, yes, I think like something like a Les Miserables, whatever iteration of it you've seen, Lily, one day we'll watch Les Miserables, did a good job of balancing the issues in and around the French Revolution, while also being, here's people singing and dancing and entertaining you. There was balance there. The balance is a bit off with In the Heights. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. But I just felt that they wanted to stay away from that and make it more about the idea of hometown pride than about the socioeconomic struggles. Those were accents, and they were sprinkled very lightly through there, but it's clear that that's not what they wanted to focus on. And I'm okay with that. I know, if there were more issues tackling that, maybe, I don't know, a song during the DACA rally or something, then yeah, maybe they could have had a little bit more, but I think it's pretty clear that that's not what they wanted to focus on.
I didn't they understand just wanted to the DACA on- stuff. They talked about it. They sang about it here and there, but I had no clue what was going on. Like that, if there was anything that was kind of incoherent about it, like for me, it was the changing of the neighborhood, the stuff with the Dreamers and the DACA. Like they talk about it in the trailer, but other than that, it went roof over my head.
Well, it was mostly to relate to Sonny, who was an undocumented immigrant, and how he realized that if he doesn't become legal, he's not going to have access to anything else. He was like, I can't get a license. I can't go to college. Can't do any of this. And it's only through Usnavi's generosity, from Abuela's generosity, that he is able to pursue the American dream and become an American citizen. Because, he has to leave the $96,000 to him, a good chunk of which is going to be used for those legal fees.
Yeah, exactly. That's mostly my thoughts. Lily, was there anything about the movie you didn't like? Anything you thought they could do better? No, it was perfect. Print.
Yeah, I liked it.
just throw Oscars at it. It's fine.
I liked it, but can't really remember what I didn't like about it.
Okay, the answer can be nothing. Alexis, anything else you want to add? I'm going to give you the last word on this before we move on to the next thing.
It's a minor thing, but I kind of wish we had seen more creative cinematography. We were talking about When the Sun Goes Down in 96,000, but those were two of the exceptions in the movie. I was hoping to see a little bit more, like you get the bits where they... when they're starting up with 96,000 and Benny is drawing and you can see little animations appearing around him.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another song, I think it's When You're Home, when he and Nina do something similar when they're drawing out the subway line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I kind of wish we could have seen a little bit more like that. Maybe some of those kind of animations like in the club number.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause they were really, really well done. And I liked them and I kind of wanted more. Not saying that the musicals, the other songs were bad, mm-hmm. or that the cinematography was lacking, but I think they could have experimented a little bit more and we could have had a few more musical numbers with some of those more creative ideas.
I think that's a great point. Your chosen medium allows you windows to do some pretty creative things. So like if you're going to shoot a film that's a musical, why not use the film medium to do something a little with a bit more animation, a bit more graphics, you know, things like that. I think that's actually pretty pretty brilliant because they do kind of touch on it here and there, like you said, like with the subway and whatever. But like I said, they don't really overuse it. Maybe some more stuff. There might have been a thought about we don't want the screen to be too busy. We've got 500,000 people on screen doing this. You know, it's just shaking their arms and their shoulders and whatnot. We don't want to busy that up too much. I want to say again, the spinning the camera and them dancing on the side of the building looked awesome. Like there was some stuff where I was just kind of passively watching going, okay, things are happening. These are likable people. I don't have any major thing. Oh my God, he turned the camera. I'm amazed. And like I said, the underwater shots also look pretty cool. If we've got it, then let's go ahead.
Wait.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Okay. The scene where they're walking on this window, when Benny and Nina are walking on the window,
mm-hmm.
and the kid is just like blank face seeing that. I didn't really like that because I feel like, well, the kid shouldn't have noticed. Then it just ruined the whole thing you're doing.
So that's actually a really funny point you bring up. I didn't think about that, but right. If this is all in the kind of in their imagination and it's, you know, it's a step out from the realism of what's happening to do this really fun, imaginative dance number, but the kid notices it's like a laugh moment that takes you out of the moment. That's actually pretty funny, Lily. What do you think, Alexis?
I thought it was kind of funny, but I guess again, I think if they'd had a few more musical numbers that they were embellished a little bit with those kind of that kind of cinematography, maybe it would have set that tone a little bit better.
Agreed. All right. So just as a point of comparison, In the Heights better than Hamilton or Hamilton better than In the Heights, Lily?
How did you threw this at me and now I can't decide.
I preferred Hamilton. I'll be honest with you. What I saw of Hamilton, I think there's a richer story in Hamilton. I think the songs are, you know, we're talking like quibbles here, but I think the songs are better. For me, I enjoyed In the Heights. It was just one of those things where I get that you love this neighborhood. And I can see why you're explaining it to us, why you love this neighborhood, but doesn't quite touch me the way your story about this neighborhood didn't hit me. I think the way it was intended to hit me, as opposed to Hamilton, which was a very relatable story that I was into. And I really want to see, you know, how as they're telling the story, I want to see how it's resolved. Within the Heights, I was like, she can go back to school. She can't go back to school. You can go to the Dominican. Do what makes you happy. I'm not as invested in this as I was in Hamilton. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying, you know, if I have to pick one, I pick Hamilton. Alexis?
I definitely pick Hamilton. But at the end, I think that's because In the Heights was done before that. And I think that Lin-Manuel Miranda, when he got to Hamilton, had improved his craft a lot more. He had experimented a lot more. One of the things I really loved about Hamilton was the blending of different music styles.
Yeah.
I always cite that they had King George singing in ELM style from that you heard more in British Invasion, mm-hmm. which fits so well. And I love that he was willing to experiment like that with these different styles. Whereas In the Heights, the music style is pretty consistent. And again, that's not bad. That's very enjoyable. But Hamilton is a better experience, in my opinion. They're both great musicals. I'm not saying, you know, In the Heights was crap. It's not.
No, for sure.
And I honestly would love to see In the Heights on stage. I really would.
Yep. Lily and her mother are going to go see Hamilton a year from December. They have tickets for it here in Tampa. But if In the Heights ever does a stage production, I would not say no. I would go. I think that would be fun. Lily, you want to take a crack at which one you like better? One more time? You want to take a second at bat? Nope.
I can't. When it comes to the two movies I really liked, I can't choose.
All right. Are you trying to tell me this?
Get on with it.
Yes, get over it. Yeah!
Alexis, you don't know this or not, but when we used to be on Block Talk Radio, I had a lot of sound clips like that I played incessantly. Fantastic. All right. Let's go ahead and get on. Well, before we do, I just want to remind everybody that if you enjoyed the soundtrack to In the Heights and you want to listen to the soundtrack, you can go ahead and click the link in the description of this podcast for AmazonMusic.com. AmazonMusic.com is giving away a free 30 days of their streaming service. You can listen to In the Heights. You can listen to Hamilton. You can listen to Bongzilla. You can listen to Dr. Colossus. Yes, Lily.
And if you can, you can also search the Hamilton. You can also search Hamilton Polka, and there's a song by Weird Al Yankovic, and he did a funny song.
He did. Weird Al Yankovic, very known for his polkas. You can listen to the entire, and I would, listen to the entire Weird Al collection on AmazonMusic.com by clicking our link, getAmazonMusic.com/W2M Network for a free 30 days. You click the link, fill out the information, enjoy the music. If you want to keep it, you pay the monthly fee. If not, you cancel. No fuss, no muss. But it's a great streaming music service to use, better than Spotify, better than Apple Music. Who doesn't have Amazon? Everyone, but you know, buy stuff from Amazon. You can get your food, get your medicine, get your music, get your movies, all in one place. AmazonMusic.com. Click the link. It helps us out. Yes, ma'am.
I'll say, get your Honeysuckle Rose Creations jewelry. We have a shop on Handmade at Amazon.
Absolutely. Plug. Speaking of your businesses and making money.
Here comes the money.
Here we go. Money talk.
Here comes the money.
Yes, indeed. Let's talk about the money. How did this thing do? Now we're doing this on a Thursday, so they've had a couple of more days, but the last weekend, June 11th to June 13th, A Quiet Place Part 2 was the number one movie of the weekend, 2 weeks in a row. It's the first movie to cross $100 million domestically since the pandemic. So that's a record right there. And, you know, it's a sign, hopefully, that the theater going experience financially is returning to normal, improving, that sort of thing. In the Heights debuted at number 2 for the weekend of June 11th through June 13th. The Conjuring dropped from 1 to 3. Peter Rabbit, which my kids saw. Quick 30-second review. What'd you think of Peter Rabbit, Lily?
I don't know how to describe it. I don't like when There's like a plot twist at the end. I did not like it.
You didn't like it? Did you like the movie in general?
I did. It was funny though, seeing Peter and the guy, I forget his name, trying to connect, and then they just start breaking apart, and then they have to come back together again to save people.
I'm starting to wonder if James Corden just has the ability to say no to any project.
The Samuel Jackson of our times. Do you want to be in this? Yes. Do you know what it is? Not a clue. Don't care. Just pin me, pay me.
I'm sorry. It's like every other project has James Corden in it. It's like, dude, is this a Nick Cage situation? You know, do you need to pay somebody off?
It's funny. Cruella dropped from 3 to 5. Spirit Untamed, a new animated movie from Universal, dropped from 4 to 6. The House Next Door, Meet the Blacks 2, debuted at number 7. Wrath of Man, which came out the beginning of May, dropped from 6 to 8. Queen Bees, which made its debut this weekend from Gravitas Ventures, debuted at number 9. Spiral dropped from 7 to 10. Godzilla vs. Kong dropped from 9 to 11. 12 Mighty Orphans, which my son, believe it or not, wants to go see. It's a picture from Sony Pictures Entertainment, and it's about... it's about orphans playing football from like a million years ago. Pretty interesting looking movie. Looks very indie. I have to check it out. That debuted at number 12. Raya and the Last Dragon from Walt Disney dropped from 5 to 13. Dream Horse 10 to 14. Witnesses 11 to 15. The Croods is still in theaters? Second week in a row at number 16. Domino Battle of the Bones 17. Censor 18. And rounding out the top 20, Those Who Wish Me Dead, 12 to 19, which is also on HBO Max, along with In the Heights. And here today, second week at number 20, it looks like. For those keeping score, Mortal Kombat dropped from 15 to 21. Mm-hmm. I didn't mention it before, but In the Heights had a $55 million budget. It's currently, according to Wikipedia, made $11.7 million. And I have an article here from Variety about why it might be lagging at the box office, which we'll get to in just a moment. Worldwide, here's where we stand. Hi Mom, number 1, Detective Chinatown, number 2, Godzilla vs. Kong, 3 at $441 million. F9, The Fast Saga, which had its world, which is debuting around the world, hither and thither, hasn't a week from tomorrow on the June 25th, it makes its domestic debut, which we have tickets for already. Yay, Lily. Right, Lily?
Yay.
Well, that was enthusiastic.
Hot damn. Well, we've been through 6 weeks of this and 7 movies. She's getting a little tired of these. You know, we need a break, but we're gonna finish this off. So Fast 9, at least worldwide, minus the United States, is sitting at $270 million. Quiet Place 2, $211 million. Quiet Place 2 is kicking ass. Impasse, $180 million. Cruella, $150 million. A Writer's Odyssey, $149 million. Ryan the Last Dragon, $133 million. And finally, in the top 10, Sister, at $128 million.
Can we just have a moment to realize that the mouse is not in the top 5, or not taking control of the top 5 spots like it usually does?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. You know, well, they also haven't had too many releases yet. I mean, by this time 2 years ago, like the Avengers and stuff had come out. So, you know, I think given enough time, you'll start to see more Disney movies in the top 10. You know, and Cruella is also not a great measurement of it. People who saw it seem to have liked it, but it's also, I think, one of those movies, kind of listening to a lot of the feedback on it, and even go back and listening to our own podcast, it's like, Cruella, the movie nobody asked for. So,
and nobody knows why it exists.
Right. So I think there might be some genuine interest, you know, out there in it, and people who are interested saw it, but you can also buy it at home on, you know, on Premier Access. So it's hard to measure. The one that we'll see Disney return to the top 10 and return to form is going to end up being Black Widow, and then followed thereafter by Jungle Cruise. So I think with everything sort of shifting to late June, July, and August, I think by September, we'll have a better feeling of what the top 10 is going to look like, you know, and whether or not some of these major studios, you know, and to your point specifically about Disney, whether Disney's going to return to like dominating the top 10. Because remember, like, what was it, 2019, 8 out of 10 pictures in the top 10 were all Disney pictures, Alexis?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. It's like, wow, the mouse is not in complete control of the top box office. This is random as hell.
I just want to talk about this article from Variety here. HBO Max isn't to blame after In the Heights fizzles at the box office. So In the Heights, a lauded adaptation of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway musical, fell short of box office expectations. It would be easy to point to its hybrid debut in HBO Max as the culprit. But streaming isn't necessarily to blame for the movie's lackluster 11.4 million four-day opening. Yes, it's possible that some HBO Max subscribers opted to watch the movie at home rather than venturing out to theaters. Depressing overall ticket sales. And we don't know we don't have any data on how well it wasn't watched on HBO Max. In reality, In the Heights was facing much larger obstacles than easy to reach TV remotes. It's not really a box office versus streaming problem, says Sean Robbins, the chief analyst at Box Office Pro. In the Heights had a strong core fan base, but it didn't expand beyond that. So, right. So I want to just break and talk about that point, Alexis, that part of the problem within the Heights is this is a very niche product. What do you think?
Yeah, I would say so. Again, we were talking about how they really didn't tackle a lot of socioeconomic issues. They were sprinkled in, but not really talked about. This was a celebration of their neighborhood. Right. And I think that this is a film that's going to hit stronger to the target demographic of Latin American immigrants and such, very similar to the cast and the the characters in the musical. So, obviously we're a couple of white people, you know, from from Florida and Missouri, you know, we're not the target demographic there.
No, the Venn diagram is basically, you know, the circle of people who like musicals, a circle of people who are Latin Americans, and the certain circle of people who live in the, you know, New York City metro area. And, you know, and that space in the middle is, you know, what of the Latin American Washington Heights living theater enjoying people are going to go see this movie. And it's, you know, that portion in the Venn diagram is relatively small. And so, like, not everyone that likes musicals is still going to be interested in this. It's not like it's got 100%. It's a portion of those people who are like, I'll just go see anything with singing and dancing. But how big is that? How big is that population to generate ticket sales? And then again, you know, not every Latin American person is going to want to go to see this. They, you know, some like, hey, I want to see something that relates to my experience and my, you know, and my people. I don't necessarily need to see them singing and dancing though. So, you know, it's that's why I keep going back to that Venn diagram. It's like, on the one hand, it's supposed to be a broad appeal, general audience movie. On the other hand, it's a very niche presentation with a very niche topic. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Robbins noted that recent offerings from Warner Brothers, particularly Godzilla vs. Kong, Mortal Kombat, and The Conjuring, each scored solid box office receipts despite opening on HBO Max at the same time. Just a real quick point there. Theaters were just starting to open with Godzilla vs. Kong. They've been open a couple of months now.
Mm-hmm.
As the movie business recovers from the pandemic, Warner Brothers is putting its entire 2021 film slate, like Space Jam and Dune, much to legacy chagrin, on HBO Max in an effort to boost streaming service subscribers. In post-vaccine times, theatrical movies have drawn the biggest crowds, were mostly sequels that hailed from popular franchises. That's been a big theme of this, is that basically if it's a known entity, people will go to the theater. If it's unknown, and I didn't know what In the Heights was until I had to do research for this podcast. And we had a theater friend also, Elizabeth, you know, who had read the book, seen the stage play, and was like an expert on the subject. I actually wanted her to be on this podcast too, but no such luck. But, you know, like, not everyone knew that. I certainly didn't know. When I started seeing trailers for In the Heights, I was like, I don't know what this is. Turns out it was adapted from two different mediums. But, you know, to the point of only known entities are drawing crowds, that's another thing working against this movie. I would agree with the article in the notion of who's running out to go see this thing, who knows about it. You know what I mean, Alexis?
Definitely.
Warner Brothers vaguely reaffirmed the notion that streaming isn't cannibalizing box office sales, with the studio's president in domestic distribution, Jeff Goldstein, telling the Associated Press on Sunday morning that HBO Max wasn't entirely at fault. Our experience, which is backed up and in the height, is that if the movie hits a high level in theaters, it hits a high level on the service. That I think is interesting. You know, there's only so many people in the world, but apparently there's enough that you can have both watching at home and in the theaters and it not necessarily cannibalizing each other. What do you think about that, Alexis?
Kind of hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I mean, they are right that more established, what's the word I'm looking for here?
IP.
Yes, more established IPs are going to draw more of an audience. You know, this one was really banking on the fact that it's Lin-Manuel Miranda. It's the guy who gave us Hamilton. In fact, I'm going to be honest, if it wasn't Lin-Manuel Miranda, you asked me if we should do this, and I said, yeah, Lin-Manuel Miranda, it's obviously. If it wasn't him, this probably wouldn't have been on the show.
Right. Perfect. I'm going to skip down a little bit. Despite stellar reviews and strong audience scores, In the Heights proved difficult to market for several reasons, though it was certainly not for lack of trying. If you turned on cable in the past few weeks, chances are you've been treated to a trailer for In the Heights. The studio embarked on a massive campaign to promote the film through costly TV spots, influencer screenings, and social media hits featuring Ariana Grande, Oprah Winfrey, Reese Witherspoon, and Hugh Jackman. Ahead of its theatrical release, Warner Brothers screened the movie at the Tribeca Film Festival. In the Los Angeles Latino International Film Festival, earning a great deal of media coverage in the process. There was enthusiasm and hope that a movie like this would create huge interest in movie theaters because it benefits from communal experience, says Paul Dergarabidian, a senior media analyst with Comscore. However, he adds that musicals are a fairly mixed bag in terms of box office results. It's not like horror movies, which have a very consistent track record. Yeah, that's... In your experience, Alexis, and it's not something I've studied real closely, but, you know, like Cats was a bomb, obviously. I mean, Lily and I loved Cats, but I loved it because I'm a weirdo. And Lily, you loved Cats because Cats?
Cats, and it was a musical.
Right. So, you know, there were weirdos out there like us that liked it. But, I mean, Cats got really bad word of mouth. There was the whole bunghole controversy, which now whenever someone brings up a cat, I have to ask with or without bunghole. That's a thing. But I think in general, from what your experience, Alexis, and if you don't know, that's fine. You know, do musicals tend to do well at the box office, or is it always kind of a middling to fair success, if not that at all?
Usually musicals have done predominantly well, especially in recent years. But I think it's because we get a lot of musicals that can reach a wider audience, per se, not to mention ones that can really experiment and play with what they give us. I always go back to the film production of The Producers.
Mm-hmm.
Not the original 60s film with Zero Mostel, but the film adaptation of the musical with Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane. I saw The Producers 3 times on stage. I love it. It's one of my favorite musicals of all time. So I saw the movie, and the movie, they didn't take advantage of, you know, being on film. I think there's maybe one scene where they actually go off of what would be considered a set. So much of the movie, they played it just like it was a film adaptation of the Broadway show.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, you know, and then you think about films like Chicago, which is very, very hard to interpret from stage to film. But Rob Marshall really found a creative way to do that. And it was massively successful.
The article, and I clicked out of it now, but the article also brought up The Greatest Showman, which its initial splash, not great, but it ended up doing pretty well at the box office. I know we were pretty big fans of it.
Greatest Showman, otherwise known as just do us all a favor and buy the soundtrack and skip the film.
All right, let's go ahead and I want to talk about this really quick. Lin-Manuel Miranda addresses In the Heights color criticism. I'm listening. So this broke. So the initial story was essentially it was getting backlash for, as the article says, sidelining Afro-Latino presence in the real Washington Heights neighborhood. So essentially, like, not casting enough Afro-Latinos and just casting a majority regular Latinos. That's a terrible way to put that. But just Latinos, not Afro-Latinos in the movie. And so the article I grabbed, though, was that Lin-Manuel Miranda addressed it, you know, and had something to say about it. Because the initial kind of thing was people saw the movie, was like, hey, not enough Afro-Latinos in this. And then people sort of reacting to that, you know, taking aside, yes, I agree with this. This should have been better. People then saying, stop being so focused on representation and just be happy that this exists in the world. But I don't even want to address sort of the debate around that, because I want to hear what Lin-Manuel Miranda had to say. So Warner Brothers' adaptation of Lin-Manuel Miranda's Tony-winning musical In the Heights has been promoted as a long overdue corrective to the underrepresentation of Latinos in Hollywood. And yet during the film's opening weekend, the discussion trended online over the movie's failure to accurately represent its namesake neighborhood Afro-Latino population. On Sunday, a video from The Root went viral in which host and producer Felice Leon confronted director John M. Chu, actors Melissa Barrera, Leslie Grace, and Gregory Diaz IV over colorism in the film's casting choices. What would you say to folks who say that In the Heights privileges white passing and light-skinned Latinx people? Chu acknowledged that it was a fair conversation to have, adding, I hope that encourages more people to tell more stories and get out there and do it right. I didn't realize until making this movie that I didn't really get to see myself or people look like my siblings that are darker than me on screen, said Grace. The only Afro-Latina among the principal cast so many times we're put on screen in one particular way. And since we get so little opportunities, everyone wants to claim that one story because it's all we've got. On Monday afternoon, Miranda responded to the criticism. I hear that without sufficient dark-skinned Afro-Latino representation, the work feels extractive of the community we wanted so much to represent with pride and joy, he wrote on a message posted to Twitter. I'm learning from the feedback. I thank you for raising it, and I'm listening. All right, so you can see what he wrote here for those of you listening on regular podcast. I started writing In the Heights because I didn't feel seen. And over the past 20 years, all I've wanted for all of us, to feel seen. I'm seeing, and boy, is that a big part of this. I definitely got the sense of the, you know, people in the community wanting to be seen and heard and acknowledged. That was a big theme of In the Heights. I'm seeing the discussion around Afro-Latino representation in our films this weekend, and it is clear that many in our dark-skinned Afro-Latino community don't feel significantly represented within it, particularly among the leading roles. I can hear that hurt and frustration over colorism, a feeling still unseen, and the feedback. I hear that without sufficient dark-skinned Afro-Latino representation, the work feels extractive of the... Okay, I've already read that part. I'm truly sorry. I'm learning from the feedback. I thank you for raising it, and I'm listening. I'm trying to hold space for both the incredible pride in the movie we made and be accountable for our shortcomings. Thanks for the honest feedback. I promise to do better in my future and projects and dedicated to learning and evolving. We all have to do. Make sure we are honoring our diverse and vibrant community. Siempre, Lin-Manuel Miranda. All right. So, Alexis, what's your reaction to really the whole thing of it? What's your reaction to the controversy and then his response?
We're never going to win. Lin-Manuel Miranda, your response was very well written and answered very nicely. Bravo. But I would like just once for a movie to come out where they are clearly trying to have more representation of more diversity, and yet people still don't bitch. I mean, didn't we talk about this on when we reviewed Raya and the Last Dragon? And then people were complaining about...
Not Asian enough.
Yeah, and they said the same thing with the trailer for...
Wrong kind of Asian.
Yeah, exactly. And then they said the same thing about the trailer for... the new martial arts Marvel movie, which I am
Shang-Chi.
Thank you. Yeah. We're never going to win. We are never going to please enough people. There are still going to be people saying it's like not Asian enough, not black enough, not, you know,
the wrong kind of blacks, the wrong kind of Asians,
yeah,
the wrong
exactly. kind
of Latinos. Yeah. I'm of two minds of this. Cause I like what Lin-Manuel Miranda said. Like here's the thing. I think in the casting, you should cast the best actors for the job. I think you should get, you know, for production, I think you should get the best talent. But I think what we've learned over the past 100 years, whether it's forced on you by government or you're shamed into it by culture, or just because you believe that it is the right thing to do and that third one is the right answer, getting people of different varieties involved in any job or project, you know, not just hiring one kind of person. I think the most important thing should be the finding the best people, but I think, you know, I think diversity does count for something. So I get that part of the argument. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step, though. I think something like this, I think you can point to it and say, could have had more Afro-Latino people in it, but good first step. I think the problem is how the argument is framed. Hand motions. Is that it tends to always be laced with venom, like they did it on purpose. You know, like Lin-Manuel was like, only the pretty light-skinned Latinos for this, okay? You know, like they're casting. And it's not like, well, who are the best, you know, most gorgeous-looking actors we can find? It was like, but make sure they're light-skinned for the love of Christ. I don't think that's what happened in the casting office. I think it was best people for the job, most talented people, etc., that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Just kind of any last word on this, and then we will do the critical review, and then we'll get out of here.
Gonna be honest, I would like actually to see how many people did originally raise this complaint, because one of the things we've started noticing when we talk about this sort of thing on our show is that the whole, all these people are saying that this was, you know, they didn't have enough different races. Maybe two tweets came out about that. Remember when we were talking about like the Pepe Le Pew controversy?
Right.
It was one guy.
Right. One guy editorial writer from the New York Times.
And then all of a sudden everyone's going, oh my God, the world thinks Pepe Le Pew is not okay in this day and age. It's like, again, it's like, how many people I'm not saying this isn't an issue. Mm-hmm. It is. But I sometimes feel like because of things like Twitter and social media, the source gets blown up to be bigger than it actually is.
All right. Let's go ahead and go to the critical. I get to play another one of my sound clips. you can tell I'm excited.
You remind me of one of my old professors who, whenever he did spreadsheets for us, he had to do every sound effect and every transition.
Who thought I would enjoy the video medium? All right, here we go with the critical review.
Are you ready? No! I said...
No, God, please, no, 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 no!
The critical review is brought to you by Grammarly. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively. Grammarly helps you write mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and nearly everywhere else you write on the web. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes while also catching contextual errors, improving your vocabulary, and suggesting style improvements. To download Grammarly today, go to getgrammarly.com/W2M network. Again, that's getgrammarly.com/W2M network to download Grammarly for free. All righty, here we go with our Rotten Tomato review. So, as you can see, pretty even score here. The critics seem to love it. It's nearly got a perfect score at 96%. The audience seemed to love it. I think my favorite one's the ones where this is wildly out of whack, but the audience seemed to love it too with a score of 95%. So let's see who hated this thing. Let's see if anyone was like, with this. Here's a good one. John Anderson of American Magazine, top critic. Why are the visuals so relentlessly static? You can't hear it, podcast people, but visual people just saw me blink twice at that. Why are the visuals so relentlessly static and boring? Why doesn't the movie soar away from the stage, doing what film versions of stage shows are supposed to do, broaden rather than strangle the virtues of the material? What?
What?
It's right there.
Well, what was he expecting for them to suddenly all float up into the air and launch into space?
Just break into Lionel Richie's dancing on the ceiling, but the ceiling is the moon. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what more he expected here. Armin White of National Review. God, this guy hates everything, I think. Miranda's cultural misappropriation in the height. What? Miranda's cultural misappropriation?
Are you kidding me?
In the Heights is the grotesque product of a mainstream culture that seeks a Latino figure who is acceptable precisely because he is politically and artistically non-threatening. Didn't they boo Mike Pence for coming to see Hamilton because they're so, like, politically one side? I don't know that much about Lin-Manuel Miranda, Alexis, but I didn't think he was politically non-threatening.
I don't even get what this guy's argument is trying to be.
I think he desperately wanted to use the phrase cultural misappropriation. Like, you know, he needed to check that off his box.
I'm sorry, does he assume that Lin-Manuel Miranda is not Latin American?
Hey, Whitey, stop whiting around. Hey, you, Manuel, stop writing about Latin people. Crazy, right, Lily?
Hmm.
Hey, Lily, this one's for you.
I'm nervous.
Victoria Alexander, a film festival today, Lily. Oh, my God. What did this person say, Lily? She says, this is a musical without songs.
It had songs. I don't understand.
If this was a cartoon, I'd have a giant question mark. So I'm like, pop over my head just going, I don't get it.
Same.
The songs, I mean, I get, like, the subtext of what that sentence is that the songs had no meaning to them. They had no subtext. You know, they didn't say anything. They're singing about, I want to go home. I want to chase the American dream. I'm having troubles with identity. What do you mean this essentially, there's this person's, these songs are empty, but I don't get that at all.
And then the one under it.
Yes, Alan, however you pronounce that, NG, film threat. Look, I just didn't like it. Good review, sir. Well, good addition to the critical sphere. I just didn't like it. Cut print. Give me a check.
That's an okay answer.
Good to know that just saying that can net you a paycheck.
I don't even know if he got a paycheck for this, but he gets to be on Rotten Tomatoes. Is that all it takes? Is a tweet?
Okay.
Jordan Romy of World of Real. Chu, who also overstylized and overdirected his debut feature, Crazy Rich Asians, is a man addicted to excess. Sir, have you never seen a Michael Bay film?
That wasn't his directorial debut.
Crazy Rich Asians wasn't?
No. He did the Justin Bieber documentaries. And he did Gem and the Holograms.
Apparently, everyone has forgotten Gem and the Holograms, and rightly so. But, you know, again, if you're going to be a reviewer, it helps if you actually research your stuff.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not going to take, you know, advice from somebody who can't even, you know, get the facts right on the people who created the project that he's reviewing. There you go.
All right, in the interest of time, this will be the last one. Daniel M. Kimmel of North Shore Movies. The young principals are attractive. Agreed. Smits adds some gravitas as the patriarch. Yes. And Olga Meredes adds some pathos in the tacked on story of the beloved elderly woman who wins the lottery. For this critic, it was to no avail. Oh, yeah.
Someone was focusing on the wrong parts.
It was like, this is good, this is good, this is good. Still sucked. Right? Thanks, pal. All right, so that's it. That is our review of In the Heights. I'll do a real quick plug of what we're doing. Allegedly, we're threatening to review Dark Side of the Ring. This is the second video we've done. The first one was earlier this morning, late last night. We did an on trial for Back to the Future 2. That was Jesse and I. We had a lot of fun with that. That's up now. If you want to see the video for it and see our pretty faces, that's on YouTube. The rest of the audio is on whatever podcatcher you like to listen on. Yesterday, we dropped a zillion shows. Not, you know, in addition to all the video game stuff that Sean Garmer is doing, released the what Schumacher cut, by the way, Alexis? Released the Schumacher cut. What are they talking about?
No idea, but apparently Schumacher, when he originally made Batman Forever, it got edited like crazy by the studio, from what I'm hearing. I don't know. Warner Brothers listened to the fans about the Snyder cut, okay? So apparently they think now they can demand whatever they want. I don't know. I just know that it was trending, and that's why I suggested we re-release our Long Road to Ruin of Batman Forever.
So yeah, there's a Long Road to Ruin that focuses on the Schumacher Batman movies, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. That's a re-air from many, many years ago. Myself and Harry Broadhurst reviewed Against All Odds with Kenny Omega versus Moose, and then NXT TakeOver In Your House with the Fatal Five Way between Pete Dunne, who is a yam, Karrion Kross, Johnny Gargano, Adam Cole, Bebe, and Kyle O'Reilly. And then Jesse dropped an Unspoken Issues for Secret Defenders number one. Our Long Road to Ruin from years ago that Robert Winfrey and I did that pissed off Jesse in the first place for Back to the Future. That's also up in the archives now, as well as Jesse and me reviewing Green Jelly's Garbage Band Kids. So everything preceding the on trial is all strictly audio. Tomorrow, we are re-airing our Inside Out review. That's to coincide with the release of Luca on Disney Plus. Plus, we're doing a live show. It'll be another video like this. We're doing a Long Road to Ruin for the Porky's trilogy. Alexis, are you just chomping at the bit to hear what Jason and I have to say about Porky's?
I'm just grateful I'm not on that show.
Sean Comer asked if he was on it too. I was like, no, sir. I'm not talking about Porky's with you. Just Jason. We've got a Pantera retrospective from back in the day that's going to get re-aired this Saturday. And then Roberts, Everyone Loves a Bad Guy, Pixar Villains will air Sunday. And then our review of Luca will be on Monday, late afternoon. Lily will be back with us again. Lily, excited for Luca?
Yes, kind of.
And Jonas has decided he will be on that podcast too. He did not want to be left out. So even though I told him no long form discussions, I'm making an exception for the Pixar film. All right, Alexis, go ahead and do your plugs.
All right. Honeysuckle Rose Creations, the intersection of geek and chic where fashion meets fandom. I also happen to be talking to one of my favorite customers here. Right, Lily?
Yeah.
How are you liking that Demon Slayer hair barrette?
I really like it. I'm going to turn off the camera real quick so I can get it real quick.
All right, go ahead. I'll keep talking. We are in the process of adding a bunch of new products onto our shelves. We are adding our new Ruby merch. We have a new Lunar Phases charm bracelet that I had a lot of fun. Oh, yep, there it is. That's our Demon Slayer. Thank you so much. I'm so glad you like it.
Yes, I really like it.
Wonderful. And of course, we are going to be making our appearance at KC Crypticon back on the road. Hallelujah. So glad to be going back to work. Woo! Cannot wait to be there. We're going to have a lot of fun horror themed jewelry. Again, you can find us on Etsy and Handmade at Amazon. We're in the process of uploading a bunch of new products. We're also restocking a ton of our favorites, including our Monopoly charm bracelets with rainbow beads, always popular, especially during Pride Month. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's Honeysuckle Rose Creations, the intersection of geek and chic.
All right. Like I said, DM you Hollywood Luca next week. In the meantime, in between time, for Alexis Haina, for my daughter Lily, say goodbye, Lily.
Bye.
This has been DM you Hollywood. Be well, be safe, and behave.